The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Martin Fletcher, Emmy Award-winning journalist, longtime NBC bureau chief in Tel Aviv, and the author of the new book, Walking Israel. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom! Spring has sprung, and we're in the midst of a truly lovely time of year, at least here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. That means that with Purim in our rearview mirror, we must be heading towards the great springtime festival of Pesach, Chag HaAviv, Passover to most of you. And so, to get us started on this fine spring morning, here's the beginning of our pre-Passover preview, our Pesachtic play-in. Here's the order of the Passover Seder, the Siman LeSeder Shel Pesach, set to two melodies and sung by the Western Winds. That was Kadesh Urchatz, the order of the Seder for Passover, as sung by the Western Winds. It's now about 3 weeks till Pesach. Time to start all the cleaning, cooking, purchasing, and preparing for the coming holiday of freedom. A lot of work for freedom, huh? This has been an interesting week. It seems that we are now at war with Libya, to go with our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, it's about time that Gaddafi left the stage. In fact, long past time. He is clearly brutal and determined enough to put up quite a fight, more than Mubarak was. And the fact that our measured, thoughtful, internationalized response took a couple weeks to put together meant that the window of opportunity for a quick turnover of government in Libya was missed. Another interesting story, in an effort to boost her international street cred, one supposes Sarah Palin visited Israel this week. Be still, my beating heart. But of far greater impact has been the after effects of the terrible tsunami and earthquake in Japan, which continue to captivate the world's attention. Our hearts go out to the victims of the twin natural disasters and the families of those who were lost. It has been a catastrophic situation and very painful to observe. The human toll is tremendous, and this in a country that is as organized and technologically advanced as any on Earth. Anything that we can do to help those who are suffering and vulnerable, we all should do. A great challenge of witnessing a natural disaster like this, for those of us who believe in God, and who believe that God is good and cares about us, is reconciling the awful loss of innocent life with those views. How can a God who loves us allow such terrible things to happen? I guess I would respond to that challenge simply by saying that the natural world God created has laws that govern it, that are part of the very fabric of creation. These rules, divine laws or natural laws, if you prefer, in their own way, are part of what makes life possible. They are not controllable by human action, or at least not yet. The magnificent earth we live on and that sustains us also changes and moves. When we live in areas that are subject to such movement, we are also vulnerable to those changes. I grew up in L.A., Los Angeles, one of the earthquake capitals of America, and I was well conditioned to the ground suddenly starting to shake randomly throughout my youth. I recall living through the early morning Sylmar earthquake in 1971, which was a mere 6.6 on the Richter scale. The ground shook violently for what seemed like forever, although in reality it was less than a minute, and I vividly recall my bed rolling back and forth across the room while lights flashed on and off wildly. I cannot really imagine an earthquake of 9 on the Richter scale. That's geometric scale. It would be many, many times greater than a mere 6.6, let alone a tsunami following it that simply obliterated entire towns. These forces are nearly beyond comprehension, but they are also a part of the natural world we live in. A huge earthquake and tsunami in an uninhabited area, of course, would impress us, but would not seem like a tragedy at all. This earthquake tsunami thing, well, these are not the direct work of God punishing someone or anyone. They're the sad result of people living in areas that are vulnerable to natural disasters. We can't always choose where we live, of course, and the human tragedy is very sad and tremendously painful. But it's also an unfortunate part of life, not any kind of judgment by God. This is the reality of living in a world with forces well beyond our control. We need to be grateful for that world and for the God who gave it, even as we strive to help those damaged by the natural forces that make it all possible. When we return on To Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Martin Fletcher, the Emmy Award-winning journalist, longtime NBC bureau chief in Tel Aviv, and author of the delightful new book, Walking Israel, right here on To Jewish in just a moment.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. When I was in junior high school, the best kisser in the eighth grade was Julie Mills. How did I know she was the best? Well, the truth is, I didn't. Because I was pretty shy back then, and including Julie, I only kissed a total of two girls. But to me, with my limited experience, Julie was the best. My point is, we almost never know when something is really the best because we haven't experienced everything else. And so it is with pizza. Sure, every day we hear Mama's Pizza is the best. It feels good to hear it, but still, we don't relax and take it for granted. After all, we're competing with a lot of pizzas out there. So, if you haven't tried Mama's Pizza yet, we humbly invite you to do it today. We believe you will think it's the best, and you'll remember it forever. Just like I remember kissing Julie Mills. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through eighth grade. It has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Judaic studies curriculum with a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports program THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking skills, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio allows its highly qualified faculty to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in the modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. They are enrolling now. Please give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll your child and to schedule a tour, call 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. That's 529-3888 for THA. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Martin Fletcher, the longtime NBC bureau chief in Tel Aviv, Emmy Award winner, and author of the new book, Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. He is one of the most respected journalists in the world. And what prompted you to decide to write what really comes off as kind of a picaresque personal guide to Israel?
Well, I guess it does really, but I intended, you know, to write a book about the Israel that I see day by day that is different from the Israel that I report on day by day, if you like, you know. And the journey that I took along the coast of Israel from the north to the south, for me, was sort of a metaphor, a way of looking differently at Israel. I hope it worked.
I think it does very well. I'm reminded of Bruce Feiler writing about walking the Bible, but this isn't walking the Bible. This is walking a real country. I think most people don't realize, as you say very early in the book, how much of Israel is lived right near the ocean.
Well, that's right. You know, when we report on Israel, and the Israel that most people see, it's sort of the Israel to the left of the Green Line, the old border of 1967. With the West Bank and Jordan, and that Israel that the world sees through the media, you know, that's an Israel that's at war. It has been at war many times, at least the occupation, the soldiers, the killing. You know, but 70% of Israelis live along the coast, in relative harmony with each other, in relative harmony with the Arabs who live amongst Israel. You know, 1 million of the Israeli citizens are Arabs, and although it's not the best of relationships, they live pretty well day by day. And I think that gets missed in the media. The world doesn't really know much about it. And that's the Israel that I wanted to take a look at.
I think you captured it quite beautifully. I'm also reminded a little bit of Amos Oz, who wrote about sort of his experience walking around Israel, but it's a much more political book. This is sort of more personal, isn't it?
Well, it is. Actually, it's very nice. You mentioned Amos Oz and Bruce Feiler's books. I wouldn't put myself anywhere near their category, but yeah. It's a personal look at Israel, but I wanted to show. I didn't ignore the problems of Israel by any means, but they're just different kinds of problems. You know, there's two stories of Israel: the story that the world sees, and there's the story of the other Israel. And I wanted to get at the heart of the other Israel, which I think is real Israel. Certainly, the majority of people, as I say, live along the coast. But yeah, it was a very personal journey, I must say. But I was trying to look at Israel from a different point of view.
We will talk much more with our guest this morning, Martin Fletcher, author of Walking Israel, when we come back on Two Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grand, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before, for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, April 19th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh, cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, April 19th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Or, if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there'll also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Jason Holtz. Call 327-4501 for more information.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. One of the most famous Jews by choice, actress Elizabeth Taylor, died last week. Before she converted to Judaism, Taylor starred as Rebecca in Ivanhoe, a premier Jewish role, and married the Jewish director and producer Michael Todd. But it was in order to marry Jewish singer Eddie Fisher that she eventually became Jewish, studying with the late Rabbi Max Nussbaum of blessed memory at Temple Israel in Hollywood. Mike Todd Jr., her son with her Jewish ex-husband Michael Todd, was her best man at her wedding. Well, one of her 8 weddings, but who's counting? Elizabeth Taylor left Eddie Fisher eventually for Richard Burton, but never officially left Judaism, although she did apparently continue to wear a cross. In another odd Jewish note about Elizabeth Taylor, much later on, she also studied, I use that word loosely, Kabbalah with celebrity Kabbalah rabbi Eitan Yardeni, this in an effort to rise from personal depression in the late 90s. Her exploration of Zohar brought her close to Madonna, the celebrity most closely associated with Kabbalah. Nothing like a little deep and often incomprehensible Jewish mysticism to help out an aging movie star or pop singer. I am not making this up. It's true. In any case, there will be many obituaries for Elizabeth Taylor, showings of National Velvet and so on. This will be a brief Jewish obit, then. May her soul be bound up in the bonds of eternal life. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Some difficult news from Israel. The first bus attack in Jerusalem since 2004. Many, many people wounded. And obviously there have been some other terror attacks, but it seems like there's been a real pickup in the level of rockets coming from Gaza, some new weaponry. Let's talk about what's going on right now.
Yeah, the last 2 weeks, it seems we've seen an increase in attempts from the Palestinian side to launch terrorist attacks against Israelis. We've seen it at the south, at the Gaza Strip, with over 50 rockets shot at the city of Sderot. We saw it with the use of new weaponry, including a French anti-tank missile that is a very advanced missile that was used for the first time. We saw it at the terrible slaughtering in Itamar, where a family of 5 was slaughtered by a terrorist. And we saw it with the latest terrorist attack in Jerusalem. It wasn't
right across from the main bus station the conference center, Jerusalem Conference Center.
Exactly. It was a bomb that was hidden within a bag, and apparently the number of casualties, there were about 38 casualties, 1 woman died, and the number of casualties was relatively lower than would have normally been from that bomb because of a local, thanks to a local shop owner that noticed this suspicious bag, and while he was calling the police and pushing people away from the bag exploded. So he actually saved several lives there by actually being aware and doing that. So yeah, it does seem to be an intentional process of escalating in the region.
Why do you think that, I'm assuming it's primarily Hamas, why do you think that there's been this push to kind of re-energize terrorism against Israel? We hadn't seen 50 rockets coming onto State Road really nearly since the Israeli invasion of Gaza a couple years ago. So why now?
First of all, regarding the sources, it's several Palestinian organizations, while the official Palestinian Authority condemns those acts.
Right, and Authority condemns it, and yeah, Fatah has condemned it.
Abu Mazen have condemned it, and this is significant because they haven't condemned those attacks in the past. So I do see this as a positive progress, but we do see Hamas and the jihad movement trying Islamic to jihad. Give a more violent voice, a more brutal voice. And in a way, it seems that they might be using the fact that public media is focusing on other arenas to launch those attacks, and also it helps them to get more weaponry into the Gaza Strip and so on.
Well, since Egypt and Mubarak has left, it seems like the border is almost wide open and they're able to move all kinds of weaponry into Israel. We saw ships being sent down that were intercepted by the Israeli Navy. We'll talk next week. Hopefully, we'll have some better news. Thanks, Guy.
See you next week. Bye.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos J Bar and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails is a wonderful new place, maybe the best in Arizona.
Well, we just won Best New Restaurant in Tucson.
I heartily concur. What's your favorite stuff on the menu?
There's so many things that we do well downtown. It's really the foods of the entire world. And so at lunch, we do this great pounded Laotian pounded papaya salad. At dinner, have the trout. Trout with oysters and cream corn. Late night, you got to have the downtown burger.
And you can hear great music there late night too, can't you?
You don't have to go to bed early. You can stay up late Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, listen to live jazz, great specials on the late night menu, great drinks, incredible cocktails we make there, by the way. It's in the name.
I have to say, try the Game Changer Soup, too. What's the phone number for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
623-7700.
Or it's www.downtownkitchen.com.
That's it.
We'll see you there, Janos.
Thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You are, I know this will startle our listeners, just back from a trip, this one to North Africa and other places.
Yes, indeed. It was spring break at the university, so I went to Marrakesh, Madrid, Budapest, and Thessaloniki.
In a week?
Well, in about 10 days.
Okay.
And oddly, as if this were predestined, I had an incredible experience in Marrakesh, which was very closely tied into a course I taught earlier today in the Humanities Seminars program on Chaim Potok's novel, The Promise. It was very much from that world of different sects of Brooklyn Hasidim. Now, let it be said that, you know, Marrakesh is not a place where you expect to run into Hasidim.
No, not hardly.
And I arrived 24 hours later than scheduled. So I actually arrived on Saturday afternoon. It was raining and unseasonably cold. And I was kind of tired from the trip. Not a real happy camper. I take a car from the airport to the hotel. And as I get closer and closer to the hotel, I see more and more people who look like Orthodox Jewish high school kids from like an NCSY convention or something. And I'm thinking to myself, what on earth can they be doing here? It never occurred to me that they'd be in my hotel. Nor did it occur to me that only because I'm getting so old did they look so young. On closer examination, they were mostly in their 20s and 30s, not in their teens. And there was a whole range of people, from people in fur hats and long black coats to very modern Orthodox guys who dress like you or I do, but with baseball caps instead. So I'm hoping that this isn't going to be too inconvenient, and these are not the people that I normally choose to associate with. Get to the hotel, take a shower, try to take a nap. I'm too tired to sleep. So I go wander down to the bar of the hotel, and I see there are three or four of these guys, the most modern-looking, kind of Western-looking guys, sitting in the bar. And obviously they have an arrangement with the hotel whereby they can order stuff and not have to sign for it.
On Shabbos.
Right. But I see the coolest looking guy, who's wearing a very cool hat, not a baseball cap, but like a cool kind of hat, like a jive hat, is sitting reading Constantine's Sword, which is one of the main texts for two of the courses I teach. So I asked him, like, what do you think of that book? He said, well, I started reading it only because my boss told me he read it and it was great, but I actually like it. Have you read it? I said, well, I teach from it like every semester. He said, oh, really? Where? We get to talking, and his first reaction is, there's Jews in Arizona. Yeah, there are. And then he says, and there's actually a course in Judaic studies, and I let him know that the University of Arizona has one of the biggest Judaic studies programs in the country. And then we start talking a little bit more, and it turns out he's part of a group of 72 guys. And I spent the next several hours getting to know other members of this group and about this group, and they were also getting to know me because they were fascinated by this Jew who's fairly knowledgeable but doesn't wear a kippah and doesn't observe all the restrictions of the Sabbath, and also spent much of his life in the Muslim world. So, to be continued, but it's an amazing story what they were doing there and what they travel with and all that, and I'd like to share it with you and your listeners next week.
Absolutely, and we'll leave it as sort of a same bat time, same bat channel, a hanging intro pregnant with possibility for next week. We'll talk next week,
Tom. I look forward to it.
What were Hasidim doing in Marrakesh? And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A spaceship lands in the middle of Texas. As the Martians file out, a big Texan walks up to the one who looks like the leader. He asks the Martian, "Y'all got them green eyes?" The Martian answers back in a machine-like drone, "Yes, we all have green eyes." The Texan again asks, "And y'all got those antennae on your head?" "Yes, we all have antennae on our heads." The Texan is still curious, looks at the Martians, more of them. He again asks the leader, "Y'all got them long black coats?" To which the Martian says, "No, only the Hasidim." Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read one of the least appetizing Torah portions of the whole year, called Tazria in the book of Leviticus. It contains instructions on the treatment of a truly horrible ancient illness, leprosy, that still exists in the world, although it isn't much in evidence in America these days, thank God. Tazria delineates the ways in which we are to treat individuals afflicted with a terrible, frightening disease that our ancestors thought was contagious. The methods specified, basically sanitary conditions and quarantine, are still used today in public health and are often considered to be state-of-the-art medical means for controlling infection. Nor is there any moral valence placed on those who are ill. People infected with a dread skin affliction are not considered to have brought it on themselves by bad action or error. Rather, they are simply unfortunate. They are isolated for their own protection and that of the general societies. In the ancient world, this was frankly cutting-edge treatment for the infirm, far ahead of what most cultures would do even millennia later. But in our own world, we should be aware that we rarely treat those who are gravely ill with frightening illnesses very well at all. You may remember when the AIDS epidemic began, there was general panic about how to treat those infected. And with no justification, many individuals were ostracized from schools, neighborhoods, and society. While we are much better about it today, we are probably no more advanced than our Israelite forebears were 3,000 years ago in our Torah portion of Tazria. They, too, turned to God for help, but they generally treated those who were ill with compassion and care. We should do so today and learn from their example. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll talk with Martin Fletcher, the longtime NBC foreign correspondent in Tel Aviv, author of the wonderful new book, Walking Israel, when we return on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before, for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, April 19th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh, cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, April 19th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Or, if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there'll also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Jason Holtz. Call 327-4501 for more information.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Rabbi Rick Jacobs, senior rabbi of the Westchester Reform Temple in Scarsdale, New York, is the choice to become the new leader of the Union for Reform Judaism, the URJ. The selection of Rick Jacobs to succeed Rabbi Eric Yaffe, a many-time Two Jewish guest, still requires formal approval by the Union's Board of Directors, which will meet in June. Yaffe announced last year that he would be retiring in 2012 after 16 years at the helm of American Jewry's largest religious movement. As Jacob said, we are poised for a great new chapter for the unfolding of our movement. The Reform Movement is about finding new ways to grow and respond to Jewish life. One of his main areas of focus, Jacob said, would be to revitalize synagogues and engage with young professional Jews who are not involved in Jewish communal life. Synagogues cannot wait for people to walk into their buildings, he said. The synagogue has to walk into the public square and engage people, particularly Jews in their 20s and 30s. People still crave and need a deep sense of community. Jacobs has been at Westchester Reform Temple in suburban New York since 1991. He's also a board member of the New Israel Fund, the American Jewish World Service, and the UJA Federation of New York. He will become only the fourth president of the union in the last 68 years. By the way, Rick Jacobs used to be a dancer and choreographer with the Avodah Dance Ensemble, qualifications that no other head of the union has ever had. The announcement was not exactly a surprise. Jacobs has been a frontrunner for the post ever since Rabbi Yaffe announced his coming retirement. Although it is by far the most successful movement in North American Judaism, the Union for Reform Judaism faces challenges in a variety of areas, including reduced congregational funding and adapting to its own dramatically transformed organizational structure in recent years. Rabbi Rick Jacobs has been an innovative and enterprising congregational rabbi, but he has done so in one of the wealthiest areas of America, Westchester County, New York. It'll be interesting to see how he adapts to the helm of an organization that serves a wide and varied population of congregations of far more modest means and much more diverse political views. A bus bombing outside of the Jerusalem Convention Center wrought havoc this week, killing a woman and injuring more than 20 in the heart of the city, just across from the Tachanat HaMerkazit, the central bus depot. This marked the first effective terrorist attack on a bus in Jerusalem since 2004, the first in Israel since 2008. Apparently, in the wake of the revolutionary chaos permeating the Arab world right now, Hamas and the other Palestinian terrorists are afraid they are losing the world's attention. The solution, of course, is to attack Jews. Also in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he regretted the accidental killing of four members of a Palestinian family in their Gaza home by Israeli tank fire. Prime Minister's office emphasized the shooting was in response to rocket and mortar fire by Hamas at Israeli citizens, which is certainly true. It is unfortunate that Hamas continues to rain down dozens of rockets on Israeli civilians intentionally using civilians. He said, Israel has no intention of bringing about a deterioration of the situation, but at the same time, the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, will continue to act decisively to protect Israeli citizens. In other news, on the border with Gaza, three gunmen, that is, terrorists, from the Al-Quds Brigades, the armed terrorist wing of the Islamic Jihad, were killed in an Israeli airstrike. The IDF struck the terrorists on their way to launch rockets at Israel. They identified them as the terrorists who launched a Grad-style rocket at Beersheba last month. A Qassam rocket fired from Gaza struck Ashkelon shortly thereafter. Some 13 other Palestinians, including children, were injured in the airstrike. It came after four Qassam rockets fired from Gaza hit southern Israel. Israeli troops fired in the general direction of the Palestinians, who launched mortars at them also, accidentally hitting a home. Last week, Israeli troops fired on Gaza Palestinians preparing to launch an anti-tank missile at an Israeli force operating in the northern Gaza Strip. The IDF said that its soldiers hit their target. Earlier in the week, Israeli combat planes pounded the Gaza Strip in retaliation for a weekend mortar attack, the worst barrage of rocket attacks on southern Israel in 2 years. More than 50 mortar shells struck the area last weekend. The Israelis' attack hit two terror tunnels, two weapons manufacturing and storage facilities, and two additional terror activity sites. The armed wing of Hamas, Izzadin Qassam Brigades, has claimed responsibility for most of the explosives sent from Gaza. Before Israel's attack, a spokesman for Hamas, the terrorist group that controls Gaza, indicated the group was ready to return to a truce, and then they shot rockets. Fascinating. I should also note, in other news in the same neighborhood in Syria, more than 15, and it could be a great deal more than 15 people were murdered by the Syrian army because they had protested against the government. In South America, Uruguay has joined the list of countries recognizing an independent Palestinian state. Seven South American countries now, including Argentina and Brazil, have officially recognized the country of, quote-unquote, Palestine. And in a proclaimed Purim miracle, the wife of the Rebbe of the tiny Mevakshei Emunah Hasidim in Jerusalem gave birth to twin girls last Sunday on Purim. What was extraordinary is that after 33 years of trying, the successful birth took place when the mom was 52 years old, proof of both the miraculous nature of life and the sometimes amazing effectiveness of modern fertility treatments, which are accepted by many in the Orthodox world. Mazel tov to them. Now, of course, they will try for a boy to exceed his father as the head of this small Hasidic sect in Mea Shearim in Jerusalem. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest this morning on Two Jewish, Martin Fletcher, the NBC bureau chief in Tel Aviv for a very long time. He is also an Emmy Award winner. His new book is called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. Martin Fletcher has spoken about, interviewed, and been in war zones for throughout his career. He's won not just one Emmy, but five, a Columbia University DuPont Award, several Overseas Press Club Awards, for 30 years, the NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv. There's a kind of ironic quality to Israelis that I think is lost in most of the reporting. You understand it intimately. And when you talk to Israelis, you know, I love the opening story where you're floating out to sea and swim in. And can you tell that story for us?
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't a great story at the time.
No, it never is at the time, is it?
No, that's always better. And always better from a warm room in hindsight. I went sailing with a couple of friends and capsized and eventually sunk, and we had to swim back to shore. It was a catamaran, so it sunk just below the water. So we basically pushed the boat all the way. We basically got into trouble around about 8 o'clock in the evening, and we had returned to the Israeli coast at 4 o'clock in the morning, swam the whole way. And when we arrived at the beach, of course, you know, we actually landed at a place called Tel Baruch, which is just north of Tel Aviv, which is actually the hooker beach of northern, of that part of Israel. And we were welcomed by all these, well, not to put too fine a word on it, the prostitutes on the beach. And we landed amongst them, you know, now wet rubber gear. But they were charming and they were wonderful. I mean, they gave us hot tea and gave us blankets, and their driver drove us home. I must say, if you're gonna land like Robinson Crusoe on the beach to be met by the kind of the hooker with a heart of gold, it was the right thing to do.
You know, you comment quoting Ben Gurion, who said, "You know, Israel will only be a real country when it has Jewish prostitutes." Well, certainly they're there.
You found them.
In walking through Israel, what was the most surprising experience you had?
Well, you know, I found that people. First of all, it was very hard for me. My whole concept was to walk the beach, talk to strangers, and develop new ideas and look at Israel from a new point of view. But because I'm English, it's very hard for me to actually go up to people, to strangers on the beach, and just start talking. So I was actually, I wasn't surprised. It was delightful to reconfirm how friendly strangers were to me and how they opened up their hearts. And of course, there's the old story about if you get in a lift with a stranger in Israel, you know, within 2 minutes, you've told them how much you earn and when, what, and you know, all your family secrets. Well, they basically opened up to me so easily. It was just a fascinating way to look at Israel from a new point of view. So I think the surprise to me was just a reconfirmation of what a great place Israel is, frankly.
You know, so much of the reporting, you're part of the media, so much of the reporting on Israel focuses on the terrorist attacks and all the rest of it. How have people responded to the fact that this is just such a human story? Do they think in some way that it might compromise you as a journalist?
There was that issue, but, you know, I completely ignored it because I wanted to really report honestly and fairly on that country that I've grown to love. And I don't think there's any wrong with saying that, even if I'm working with NBC News or any other organization. You know, that's the way it is. And I think I explained in the book why I felt that way. I looked at Israel from as I keep saying, from a different point of view. You know, I dealt with the army and with the political issues and the Palestinians and the Israeli Arabs from a different perspective, from that perspective of actually meeting them and going home with them and not looking at them through the eyes of the daily tragedy, which is the way I and most journalists look at Israel, but from a different point of view, from their lives and the other issues, other problems they face. So no, I don't think it compromised me. I just think it's another layer of reporting that helped me understand Israel even better. I mean, I've been reporting from Israel for about 30 years, so you'd think I'd know the place by now, but I learned a whole lot during my walk, you know, which took 2 weeks, but then I spent 1 year researching the issues and the places and the people that I came across. So I think it made me a better reporter, and I hope it didn't compromise me. And I'm sure it didn't. I mean, the response to the book is from all sides, including Arabs and Palestinians, has been, you know, really gratifying.
Israeli Arabs are not really understood. They're not so well understood in Israel, but Lord knows they're not understood abroad. Can you explain a little bit about that relationship, Israeli Arabs as citizens of Israel and so on?
Yeah, well, you know, one reason they're not well understood is that we don't really do stories on Israeli Arabs. I mean, every time I've, with NBC, suggested a story about Israeli Arabs, you know, the response from the editors would be, look, you know, we don't really care about it. We care about Palestinians and Israelis. And by the time we explain who the Israeli Arabs are, you know, our 2 minutes is over. So I think there's partly poorly understood because we haven't reported much on them. I mean, Israel's population is 7 million people, of whom 1 million are Arabs, who basically are Palestinians, if you like. They call themselves Palestinians. Most Israeli Arabs do not want to call themselves Israeli Arabs. They call themselves Palestinians. They'll say, we're 1948 Palestinians. That means that after Israel was created in 48, their parents and their grandparents stayed behind in the new Israel and became citizens. They were very poorly treated in the beginning, but by today, they're much better off, and they're pretty much equal members of society in most areas. But there's still a lot of prejudice. One of the chapters that I wrote, I called them the Cream Arabs of Haifa, the Cream Arabs, because that's the way Arabs in the Middle East look at Israeli Arabs. You know, these are sort of the well-off Arabs. And it's rather a derogatory term, but they also use that term to describe themselves because they know that as Israeli Arabs in the Jewish state, even if they want their full equality, and even if in their heart of heart they'd rather there was no Jewish state, nevertheless, they live relatively well. And they recognize that. But the problem is that the level of acceptance of Israeli Arabs within Israel is pretty much based on what they've achieved, and most of them have not achieved a hell of a lot. And so the position of Israeli Arabs is very difficult in Israel. But they do, but they do vote, they do have great opportunities, but they're not accepted fully. And that is one of the key issues in Israel that still needs to be solved. And many of the people I met said that the next intifada, the third uprising, would not be by Palestinians, but would be by Israeli Arabs. I certainly hope it's not the case, but it's something that many, many analysts believe.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that before. The fascinating part for me is driving through areas where Israeli Arabs are living, you know, if not, probably not completely comparably to Israeli Jews, but then driving in Palestinian areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority where they're clearly not living anywhere near as well as they are in Israel.
Yeah, no, that's right. But, you know, I'm not really impressed by that because, I mean, I spent many years living in Africa, for instance, and reporting in Africa. And in Rhodesia and Zimbabwe and South Africa, the whites there always said, oh, well, you know, why do our blacks complain they're the best-dressed blacks in Africa? That was a phrase they used. Hmm. So the fact that the Israeli Arabs are probably the Arabs in the Middle East that have the greatest amount of democracy, the greatest percentage of university degrees, the best access to health care, nevertheless, they're not totally equal citizens, and they want their own freedom. And one of the things that I did learn during the book, which did surprise me, was the extent to which Israeli Arabs, even those who have achieved high positions in Israeli society, all say the same thing, which is, quote, something will happen. They say, one day something will happen. And by that they mean something will happen and the Jewish state will somehow disappear and get their country back. And I was actually quite shocked by that. You know, every single Israeli Arab I spoke to used that phrase. I was quite surprised.
It's a little bit stunning considering, you know, Israel's been there since 1948. And these are 1948 Arabs, as you said.
It is surprising because I thought that actually that the sense of President Peres and Bibi Netanyahu say the same thing, that economics, once the Arabs, Israeli Arabs reach a certain level of economic equality and the standard of living is high enough, they will want to maintain the status quo. But that's the premise of their concept of the phrase they use, economic peace with the Palestinians. Raise the Palestinian level of standard of living high enough and they won't want to, any more war. They want to preserve what they've got. But the reality is, I found anyway, and as I say, that was new to me, is that regardless of the standard of living of the Israeli Arabs, they want Israel eventually to disappear. They believe it will eventually disappear. In the meantime, they're happy to live as well as they can, but in their heart of hearts, they prefer Israel not to be there.
I should note that the siren in the background is actually not in Israel, but in but in England, where we're talking to you. Just want to clarify for everybody. What's your favorite story from the book?
I don't know if I have a favorite story. I think the favorite place that was very surprising to me was Ashkelon in the south, which is a town that I walked through on my journey, thinking this is a boring place. I'm probably never going to come back here again. And then 6 months later, I found myself back in Ashkelon when when Hamas in Gaza was shelling Israel, and Israel went to war with Hamas in 2008. And then I discovered Ashkelon under fire, under rocket fire, was an amazing place. I went to a place called Rogers Cafe. I went there every day, actually, for 3 weeks while the town and the area was being shelled. And most of the people in this cafe were Jews from Arab countries, from Egypt, Syria, Iraq, North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco. And they were so nice and so... they just accepted the shelling in such an equitable way, and were explaining, as Jews from Arab countries always do, that if there was, if they had the chance of sitting down with the Arabs within 5 minutes, they'd make peace, and the leaders aren't taking them there. You know, it was just an experience of being under shelling with people who were not sort of jumping up and running away, but just sat there drinking their coffee and eating their burekas and bemoaning the fact of the war, and saying, hey, you know, we can live in peace with the Arabs if only we had the opportunity to sit down with them for 5 minutes. Saying that, you know, while they're being shelled, I found remarkable. And we're just wonderful people.
Really interesting. And Ashkelon, of course, is really on the southern end of things when you were doing your walk. When you, you know, a lot of the coast is pretty affluent area, but there's also very poor pockets. Did you have that experience of sort of feeling the different parts?
Well, yeah, I mean, you feel that mostly, actually, in the Arab village of Jizil Zarqa, which is on the edge of Caesarea. The difference there between the Jews and the Arabs is remarkable. I mean, Jizil Zarqa is actually the poorest community along the coast, and it's the only surviving Arab fishing village. There used to be many, but they were all evicted after 48. But there's also differences among the Jewish populations. You pass through Ashdod, Ashkelon, there are poor areas. But of course, it's like anywhere else in the world. There's poor areas and there's wealthy areas. But I think it's fair to say that along the coast anyway, the difference between the rich and the poor is not as marked as it is in most countries in the world, apart from Caesarea, which actually, I must say, is a huge difference between rich and poor.
Sure, where there's the only golf course in Israel also, and yet the contrast there. What's your favorite place you want to go back to?
You know, Akko. I love Akko in northern Israel. I love Tel Aviv, too. Tel Aviv is an amazing place. You know, Lonely Planet put Tel Aviv in third place in terms of its favorite cities in the world just this year. But the place I love most is Akko. I love going to the old city of Akko. You know, you go there. It's a place where Jews and Arabs and Christians all live together happily side by side. And it's such a picturesque place. Having said that, I must say that was my impression as I walked through the coast. And then I had written a chapter saying, this is a real example of coexistence between Jews and Arabs and Muslims and Christians. Although it's always rather skin deep. And after I finished that chapter, about a week later, there was an explosion in the city. They were fighting each other for 5 days. But it rather killed my chapter, I must say. But I did learn from that that, you know, there are real problems in Israel, and even however relatively well the different communities do get on with each other, there are still major problems that need to be resolved urgently.
I want to thank Martin Fletcher for a great visit here on Two Jewish. His book is called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of the Nation, available everywhere. Thanks again, and best of luck with the book, and keep walking.
Keep walking, and you keep talking. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye-bye.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We all deal with deadlines. April 15th is one we all know. This year, through a change in the Arizona legislature's tuition tax credit, you can still get your tax credit for donating to Tucson Hebrew Academy through April 15th on your 2010 taxes. Now you have an extended opportunity. Ensure Tucson Hebrew Academy has resources to provide financial aid to its needy families. This is both an honor and a privilege to support Tucson's only Jewish day school. Your gift of up to $1,000 for a couple or $500 for single filers to JETCO, the organization that supports scholarships at Tucson Hebrew Academy, the kindergarten at Anshe Israel, and the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, all of that will get you a dollar-for-dollar tax credit on your state taxes. JETCO money provides financial assistance only to qualified students. Talk to your tax professional, like always. In order to make the donation to THA and JETCO, go to jetco.org, JETCO.org, or call 647-8442. It's a good thing to do. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Patty Friedman, author of a new ebook called, Believe It or Not, This is Great, Too Jewish. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover preview of Pesachdik music. It's from the fun CD, Reggae Passover, a Shehechianu, prayer for all new festivals, sung at the start of the Seder, now about 3 weeks away. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam,
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.